Donc Rebecca Vanhoof, qui est à moitié compatriote avec moi, puisqu'elle est belgo-anglaise, belgo-britannique. Donc Rebecca Vanhoof a poursuivi ses études en histoire et en philologie classique à l'université d'Édimbourg, en Écosse. Puis elle a soutenu en 2017, College à Londres, une thèse de doctorat sur le thème, je résume brièvement, la religion, donc l'usage de la religion et des données religieuses dans les discours des orateurs attiques. Puis, après cette soutenance, Rebecca a passé une année de postdoctorat comme visiting scholar au Max Weber Institute de Erfurt, puis 9 mois à Cambridge, si j'ai bien compté, et puis elle a posé sa candidature pour une bourse de la Leverhulme Foundation pour un postdoc hors Angleterre. Et c'est là qu'elle m'a contactée. On s'était déjà rencontré une fois à un séminaire de doctorants, mais c'est là que Rebecca m'a contactée parce qu'elle désirait, pendant ces 2 années de postdoc, travailler avec moi. Donc elle est venue ici, au collège, donc c'est en quelque sorte un retour, pendant 2 ans. Puis elle est partie très, très fugacement à Gand, dans un autre postdoc. Et puis, le hasard, parce que c'est le hasard, quand j'ai invité Rebecca et Saskia à venir parler, Rebecca n'avait pas encore son poste à Groningen, mais elle a aussi été nommée sur un poste à Groningen, mais en histoire ancienne. Et donc voilà, deux jeunes postdocs qui sont passés dans mon service et qui ont eu un poste qui me réjouit infiniment. Et le hasard fait que c'est dans la même université. Donc voilà, je suis donc très... très heureuse d'accueillir Rebecca, qui va nous parler donc aujourd'hui des Theoi headings, donc la mention des Theoi sur au fronton des inscriptions grecques. Et c'est précisément le projet qu'elle avait présenté à la Leverhulme Foundation pour obtenir la bourse. Et donc voilà, c'est un juste retour des choses qu'elle vient de nous présenter ici au collège, le fruit de cette investigation. C'est à toi, ma chère Rebecca.
Merci beaucoup, Vinciane, et merci beaucoup pour l'invitation et cette opportunité de discuter de mes recherches ici aujourd'hui au Collège de France. I will also switch to English, if you don't mind, and again apologize for my voice. Hopefully my voice will last during this presentation, but I apologize in advance if it turns into a bit of a struggle. So I want to talk to you today about a single simple term, theoi, gods, and I want to start by presenting 2 examples. The first comes from a graffito found on a potsherd on the Athenian Agora. It was found together with other such pottery fragments in a deposit of debris in the northwest corner of the Agora, where a public dining facility was located. The graffiti, the graffito is inscribed on the bottom of a pot, as you can see here, and it's dated to the second quarter of the 5th century. It records some names of individuals and calls them kalos, beautiful. Pericles, Pyxonos, or son of someone, kalos, Timoxenos, Kalos, Hermides, Kalos. We have many graffiti from ancient Greece which name individuals like this and add these appellations of beautiful, or sometimes the insulting counterpart, katapugon, lewd, to them. These Kalos inscriptions, as they are usually called, are regularly found in private dining contexts, where they have been understood as part of the flirtatious fun-making culture of the symposium. What is interesting here is on our graffito is that it frames its names and kalos designations in a very unusual way. The text is presented in a grid pattern and includes also on the left-hand side twice inscribed the word theoi, gods. Anne Steiner, who has studied this graffito and others that have been found with it, has argued that many of these graffiti can be understood as parodies of the practice of ostracism. They make fun of the democratic institution designed to curb elite powers in the larger culture of fame of which it was a part. The graffito with the Theo inscription takes this imitation of public text a step further, however. The incised grid pattern of the graffito is very similar to the grids used on stone stelae to guide the inscription of Stoichedon writing, which is very rarely found on pots, but obviously common on stone inscriptions. Secondly, then, we have this Theoi, gods, an invocation which appears extremely regularly as a heading on different types of public inscriptions throughout the Greek world. This graffito, then, appears to be a parody of a public inscription, a parody of the many decrees, laws, financial accounts, and public regulations which were regularly inscribed on stone and set up throughout the landscape of Greek poleis. The Theoi heading, together with the Stoichedon pattern, acts here as identifier of the genre of public inscription. And so what this unusual graffito does is tell us that the term Theoi, already in the 5th century BC even, carried with it certain connotations, was seen as a recognizable and unmistakable element, not of any inscription, but of a certain type of inscription, of the monumental official text which recorded collective decision-making or action. So this graffiti gives us an indication of that, how the Theoi heading came to be seen as a perhaps rather formulaic element. A second example, which is the earliest dated occurrence of Theoi on stone in Athens, can perhaps give us some clues as to what the Theoi heading actually meant. This inscription here on the left is part of the financial accounts for the construction of a new statue of Athena. This statue, which was designed by the famous sculptor Phidias, was constructed for the Parthenon as part of the extensive Periclean building programs on the Acropolis in the late 5th century. The inscription was abandoned at line 5, as you can see, and a second attempt was made on a new stone. This is the inscription on your right. This complete version, which records the expenditures of the treasures of Athena in building the statue, includes spaces on the left-hand side of the stone for a column of figures. Perhaps the stone cutter abandoned his first attempt because he realized he had not left enough space for the numbers. In any case, on the first version, we have his first line, the invocation, Theoi Athena Tuche. In the new version, however, this line is left out. So this is curious. We find here first the inclusion of a heading, which is extremely rare still for the time, and which not only invokes the general gods, but also Athena, the subject of the statue with which the inscription is concerned, and Tuche, fortune, fate. But on the second attempt to inscribe this information, these invocations are then left out. Recently, scholars have shown how the accounts for the statue of Athena differ from other contemporary accounts of the Periclean building programs on the Acropolis. These other accounts for the Parthenon and the Erechtheion, for example, are much more like proper examples of official bookkeeping, Theodore Scheer, for example, has shown. In contrast, the accounts for the giant Athena statue are much less detailed. Not only that, but their appearance differs too. One stele, which is a summary of the works carried out for the statue, is often considered one of the most beautiful inscriptions of the 5th century, with large, careful lettering and a very polished background. The documents displayed or published by the overseers of the golden statue seem much more like statements for display, as if their purpose was to memorialize the financial effort involved in setting up the monument of Athena's statue. So here then, we find this early Athenian Theoi heading in a context where particularly careful attention is paid to the inscription process, and which demonstrates also the symbolic function of inscriptions. They are not only texts, but also objects. Monumental objects set up and displayed in a particular place to be viewed, not only read, and to interact with their surroundings. The fact that this heading invokes not only Theoi, but also a specific deity, Athena, and then Tuche, as well as the fact that these divine names are then omitted again in the final version of this inscription, highlight some of the complexity, often unrecognized, of interpreting invocations like Theoi. We'll come back to this inscription also later. What does it mean to add the term Theoi or divine names to a document such as this one? So these two early and striking occurrences of the Theoi heading demonstrate, I think, the intriguing nature of this pervasive, yet sporadic, plain yet mysterious inclusion of the divine on inscribed documents in Greece. Long noted, the Theoi heading has also long been passed over and has actually received very little systematic investigation. For a long time, the only two substantial studies were two unpublished PhD theses from the 60s and 70s, until a recent article by William Mack, who has now examined Theoi headings on Attic decrees. This general lack of much sustained analysis is a consequence of the fact that the heading is usually considered not to require much analysis. The Theoi heading is often put swiftly aside after vaguely and conjecturally explaining it either as a consecration formula, an echo of a prayer, or more generally as an appeal to the divine. Many interpretations consider the heading's appearance formulaic, and with formulaicness comes the assumption of an absence of significance. Formulaicness has also been assumed for the heading Acta Tuche, which can at times be found alongside Theoi. It becomes the more common one of the two in the Hellenistic period and has often been considered a replacement of Theoi. In the Hellenistic period and later, these headings do appear to become rather standardized in terms of their usage, but their early occurrences, I think, show a more varied and complex picture. Which gods exactly are being referenced here? What is the function of this formula? And how does it relate to the inscribed text which follows it? What exact role are these gods here assigned? Obviously, I'm not able to today perhaps provide answers to all these questions, but what I'm interested in doing is seeing whether it is possible to take the Theoi heading seriously as a reference to the divine, and to explore here today some of the consequences of doing so. So I'm going to start by giving a very brief overview of Theoi headings and what they look like, where we find them, using Oropos as a case study, before focusing on the question of the heading's interpretation. So four different suggestions have been made for how we could interpret it. And I want to suggest a new way of understanding the heading and its function by doing two main things. First is to place the Theoi heading in a broader context of other types of divine formula found on inscriptions, references to individual deities or to Agathe Tuche. Because I think by contextualizing Theoi and examining the formula in dialogue with other ways in which the gods are inscribed on documents, it is possible to better comprehend the subtleties of this phenomenon's meaning. Secondly, to understand what Theoi refers to, I want to focus on an aspect which I think is crucial and which is the non-specificity of the Theoi-Theos formula. So, to start off with a very quick overview, Theoi as a term is found at the top of texts inscribed on stone throughout the Greek world, on laws and decrees and other public documents. So it appears for the first time in Crete in the late 6th century before spreading across the Greek islands and mainland. We find it in over 60 different city-states and communities. Here are some numbers for the archaic and classical periods up to the end of the 4th century. And as you can see, we have about 102 Theos headings and 279 Theoi headings. The vast majority are found in Athens, followed by Delphi, with central Greece also having quite a few, Macedonia then too, and quite a low spread across the islands. These statistics, of course, need to be approached with a lot of caution. Theoi headings have historically often gone unremarked, with some early editors leaving them out of their epigraphic collections. Analyzing the frequency of Theoi headings is also complicated by the fact that many surviving stelae are fragmentary and do not always have intact top parts. So the numbers given here should be seen as an estimation of the heading's presence, spread, and frequency, rather than definitive counts. What's important is that we see quite a lot of variety in the format and presentation of the heading. To illustrate this, I'm going to briefly look at the inscriptions from Oropos, territory between Boeotia and Attica. Oropos is a useful example because it has a small but varied epigraphic body and illustrates some of the characteristics of the divine formula that we see across the wider Greek record. So the sanctuary of Amphiaraus at Oropos, which was an incubation sanctuary, was used as a place for display for inscribed texts. We find here regulations concerning the sanctuary itself, and also degrees awarded by Oropos as well as by the Athenian assembly, as the Athenians take control of the town at certain points during the 4th century. Vasileis Patricos' publication of the inscriptions of Oropos lists about 97 inscribed texts from the classical period. Most are dedications or epitaphs without theoi, but there are 19 decrees, 13 of which have a heading invoking the gods. And we also find theoi on a sanctuary regulation. Here you see an overview of the theoi headings. What is interesting is, again, the variety that we see here, even in this very small sample. As you can see, the text of the actual headings themselves show variation. We find theos in the singular and theoi in the plural. Oropos 2 is an example of theos, as you can see very clearly here, the singular. And we also find Tuche Agate included sometimes with for good fortune alongside theoi. Here you can see on this squeeze from Oropos 4 that Agate Tuche is included here. And you also see that the heading is presented in a very different way, as part of the Stocheron pattern, not on its own line, so it doesn't stand out in the same way. The heading is presented in general in different ways, as noted here in the last column. For example, it's sometimes on its own line on the left, sometimes also spread out across the top of the stele. You can see the theta quite clearly here. Or even on the moulding above the main inscribed surface, as here, where you see the epsilon. And we also note that the type of text where we find this heading. So many proxony decrees, honorific decrees, and one sanctuary regulation. So this very quick overview from Oropos shows a little bit the diversity of the ways in which the heading gods occurs. A few important characteristics of the formula can be extrapolated from this. So first is it occurs in different formats. It is sometimes inscribed in such a way that distinguishes it from the text, perhaps making it more legible, but this is not always the case. Second, the heading occurs nearly always on documents inscribed by a civic public body, on public decision-making documents. And third, while the plural version of the heading is better known because it's this version which is employed in Athens, other Greek states commence decrees and other inscribed documents, sometimes with theos, sometimes with theoi. Delphi is an example of a place which uses both, and the inscriptions from Oropos show it does so too. What is more, they illustrate a trend that we see across the epigraphic record. There does not seem to be a discernible explanation for why the divine is sometimes invoked in singular or in plural. There is no difference in terms of subject matter or type of inscription following it, nor do we see a simple pattern in terms of geography or chronology. For example, if we look at the ones from Oropos, Oropos 3 is from a similar time period as Oropos 1 and 2, but number 3 has theoi, unlike the other two. Oropos 4 and 5 are proxony decrees like Oropos 1 and 2, but again uses the plural instead of the singular heading. It is clear that here the singular or plural are interchangeable. They are simply two different forms for the expression of the same idea. What exactly the idea is that rests behind this invocation, of course, remains the crucial question. Taking into account the interchangeability of theoi theos, helps clarify at least a very basic yet central question, which is that of the heading's grammatical case. Theoi is usually understood as either nominative or vocative. If we take theoi as a vocative, the act of inscribing the heading would make the inscription, of course, an address to the divine. However, the case for the vocative is undermined by the widespread occurrence outside of Athens of the singular theos and its apparent interchangeability with theoi. Theos in the classical period does not appear to have a vocative in the singular, which therefore supports a nominative reading. So as I already mentioned, scholars have interpreted the theoi heading in different ways. And in general, we can sort of separate out four different interpretations. The first is as a reflection of ritual. So some scholars have suggested the heading can be read as a reflection of the assembly's opening prayer, which in turn was also an appeal to favor from the gods. A second interpretation sees it as a consecration formula, so as a sort of dedication to the gods, dedicating the stone to the gods. In this reading, theoi denotes that the stone stele with its decree or law or regulation is offered to the divine. A third interpretation sees it as an appeal to divine protection or divine favor. Here, theoi or theos is then taken as a blessing formula, as a request to the gods to protect the document inscribed on the stone, or rather the decisions and actions which the document broadcasts. More recently, William Mack has offered a new perspective. Theoi, he proposes, places the gods in the role of active agents. He advocates that the heading could also be read as itself suggesting divine involvement in the actions described in the text below the heading, and thus that the theoi heading suggests that the human decisions of the Athenian demos, and Mack focuses on Athens, were underwritten in some way by divine authority. So these interpretations are all quite varied, and they present very different pictures of the relationship between the divine and the mortal sphere. Some of these suggest theoi is a communication to the gods, asking for favor or benefaction, mirroring a ritual action, or even a ritual action in itself, presenting the stele as belonging to the gods. Whereas Mack suggests a stronger reading, the invocation theoi not as a request, prayer, or wish, but as an assertion of the gods as actors, as active agents, a communication about the gods, the nominative being here important here. I think Mack's interpretation is very valuable, and I would argue that it's in this direction that we need to go to comprehend what this invocation of gods, so frequently inscribed on stones, really means. To show why I think so, let's take a closer look at these different interpretations. They actually correspond, I argue, to other divine formula which we found on find on inscriptions, so not to the theoi theos heading. As such, it is by contextualizing theoi in a broader context of ways in which deities are included in inscriptions that I think a fuller, more nuanced picture emerges of what meaning and significance such formulae actually carry. So let's start with the first idea, the idea of theoi as a reflection of the Athenian assembly's prayer. Of course, the heading is found far beyond Athens, and so does this anthropocentric reading doesn't really fit very well with the totality of our evidence. Secondly, the heading's haphazardness also discounts against this reading. The fact that theoi or theos was not included on all inscriptions of a particular type in a particular time or place is in and of itself an important characteristic of the heading and suggests that it cannot be understood as a ritual necessity. Invoking the gods on the published record of a decree was evidently not considered essential to the working and enactment of a decree and is therefore unlikely to be a mirror of a ritual which was part of a public decision-making process. Secondly, there's the idea that theoi is a consecration formula, that it contains the notion of dedication. This is obviously, in general, a very common way in which the divine is present in epigraphic contexts. On dedications, of course, and votives, deities' names appear extremely commonly, either in the dative, indicating the recipient of a gift or offering, or else in the genitive, as a way of denoting the divine ownership of an object, for example, an altar or even a sanctuary. But such consecration formula are found on dedications, but very, very rarely on decrees. Yet we do have a few exceptional cases, one of which also comes from Oropos. This is a stele which records a decree from the Athenian Council concerning the restoration of the fountain and baths of the sanctuary. It carries as heading Hiera Amphirao, the sacred things, Hiera of Amphiraos in the genitive. We can read Hiera here as sacred things or as a reference perhaps to the stele itself, so indicating the stone, the stele of Amphiraos. We find here then on a decree of the Athenian Council a formula which explicitly consecrates the stele to a god, assigns it divine ownership. This is a rather unusual heading to find on a decree and can perhaps be explained by some other elements of this inscription which are also remarkable. It was redated by Dennis Knüpfler, former professor here, of course, at the College, to 369 or 8 BC, which means to the period of Athenian control of Oropos. This is significant, as we see in this inscription, actually, a conscious effort to give expression to the Athenians' care for this important incubation sanctuary and to mark it out as an extension of Attica soon after they take control of it. It is the first inscription at Amphiaraon to employ Attic demotics, and specific emphasis is placed in the inscription also on the priest of the Amphiaraon. He's twice explicitly mentioned in the text, and his name is also specified with a demotic. He's Antikrates from Decaleia, an Attic dean. He was honored for his justice and diligence with things concerning the Amphiaraon. So this inscription, the first inscribed decree erected at the sanctuary, as far as we know, is aimed at reflecting Athenian authority over the sanctuary to demonstrate its power to make changes and improvements to its facilities. The explicit consecration of the stele and its document to Amphiaraos, to the god, can perhaps be understood as part of this specific attempt to display Athens' control of and care for the sanctuary and its god. And we have a few other examples of documents which also employ such formula of consecration, though not many. I want to show just one other example briefly. This is not a decree though, it's a ritual norm which prescribes purity regulations for the cult of three Egyptian gods at Megalopolis in Arcadia. It is also of a slightly later date, from around 200 BC, but it's useful to discuss as it includes again a consecration formula, but this time also the Theos invocation, demonstrating clearly that they are separately conceptualized. We have here Stele of Isis and Serapis, God, good fortune, a sanctuary sacred to Isis, Serapis, Anubis. So we see here a real emphasis on the divine interest in this inscription. Not only is the stele ascribed divine ownership, but the sanctuary whose entry the stele regulates also is explicitly declared to belong to Isis, Serapis, and Anubis. That the stele only belongs to two gods, while the sanctuary to three, is interesting, but my focus here lies on the fact that the inscription includes a consecration formula, together then with the Theoi Theos formula and Tyche Agata. This plethora of divine formula makes clear the subtleties of invoking divine powers. Of course, the combination of these all together is highly unusual, but nevertheless, it shows that it would make no sense here to say the same thing three times. So we should see these different formula as each making a separate semantic contribution. A consecration formula followed by Theos, which is something different, followed by a reference to Agathe Tyche, something different again. So the idea of consecration does occur in Greek inscriptions, but as we can see, it finds a different expression than theoi. While it is of course possible to express the same idea in different ways, as we already saw today also, the occurrence together of these elements suggests they are not seen as the same thing. We can therefore rule out seeing theoi or theos simply as a consecration formula, as a dedication to the gods. So what then about the explanation of theoi or theos as an appeal to divine favor? Again, I would argue that this doesn't work because the Greeks had another way to formulate this notion of appeal through the phrase agathe tyche. We regularly find this phrase on inscriptions, often on its own, and also often with Theoi Theos, as our Oropos inscriptions, again, can usefully illustrate. So Oropos 4 and 5 both have as heading, as we saw, Theoi Touche Agate. The earliest recorded example of Agate Touche as a heading found on Crete is similar. It is an honorific decree from Gorton, dated the last quarter of the 6th century, and opens with Theoi Touche Agatai. So as inscriptional heading, Agate Touche occurs most commonly in the dative, as in the examples from Oropos, and is usually translated as with good fortune or for good fortune. The combination with the nominative Theoi suggests that the elements God or gods and good fortune are two syntactically different types of pronouncements, active agent and desired object, respectively. This distinction appears corroborated too by another early form in which the Agate Touche heading is also found, in the accusative. So, for example, this is a proxeny decree from Delphi, and we read Theoi Touchen Agatan. In both the dative and accusative cases, we see then a syntactic relationship implied with verb omitted. This presentation of Agate Touche in the accusative and dative suggests that Agate Touche and Theoi have different functions, illustrated by their different cases. Agate Touche usually in dative or sometimes accusative as the object, that which the gods are being asked for. And here Agate Touche as a heading should then also not be understood as an invocation to the deity Touche, but rather as a formulation of the desired object. So again, we see that the Greeks did appeal to favor from their gods in their decrees, and they did express the wish that the gods protect and show favor to the decisions that they made and inscribed through the phrase Agate Touche, and this is often also included in the text, not as a heading. But again, here the differentiation between this phrase and Theoi Theos is apparent. So what is Theoi then? This brings us back to Theoi. If not an appeal for divine favor or protection, not a consecration formula, not a reflection of a particular ritual, what is it? So here, Mack's study is important to bring in. As I mentioned, he points out the nominative force of Theoi and argues that it presents the gods as active agents. Mack's analysis is very much focused on Athens, as he analyzes the Theoi formula together with document reliefs, pictorial narrative reliefs depicting deities which are found only in Athens. So they allow for more interpretive possibilities concerning the exact nature of the relationship between gods and monuments. And so they are a very different kind of element from the Theoi headings, which are found not only in much greater quantity in Athens, but also occur across a much wider geographical spread. Nonetheless, Mack's perspective on the Theoi heading as a reference to the gods as active agents is very important and can, I think, be developed further. By paying attention to the fact that what sets apart the Theoi and Theos headings from, for example, document reliefs, is these headings' non-specificity. They are generic terms for the divine, and this unspecificity, I think, can help us further explore what these headings mean. Throughout archaic and classical periods, generic terms for the divine, such as not only Theoi or Theos, but also Totheion or Daimon, are commonly found across all kinds of sources. At times, it is evident that such designations were employed to refer to specific gods, which the context can usually identify. It is clear, for example, that invocations to Theos found on oracular tablets from the donor refer to Zeus, the god residing at the sanctuary. Yet at other times, the identity of the referent is less evident. Demosthenes, for example, exhorts his listeners that brave men must endure worthily whatever fate the god, or Theos, may allot them. While choruses in Greek tragedy often declare, for example, that gods, Theoi, bring about many unexpected things because a god, Theos, finds a way of achieving the unexpected. As Gilbert Francois already showed in 1957, such singular and plural forms are frequently employed alternatively without difference in meaning, as two different ways of referring to the same idea. Fersnel has shown how, broadly speaking, we can organize references to theoi as an abstract collective into two broad categories with two subtly distinct meanings. The first meaning is that the term can sort of signify the plural of theos, designating all the gods, that is, the collective gods. In this reading, theoi denotes the multitude of individual deities. These multiple gods are not anonymous, and it's this meaning which is found mostly in prayers and other acts of communication with the divine. Theoi can, however, also be a generic expression. This is the second meaning. Though grammatically a plural, from a semantic point of view, it refers to a unity, a oneness, signifying one all-governing divine principle. Theoi in this reading is therefore not distinct from, but semantically equal to theos or to theon. Versnel has shown that a primary distinction between these two notions is anonymity. In the first notion, the gods are known and named deities, while in the second notion, theoi in the generic sense are by their very nature anonymous. We can also link approachability to this. In the first notion, the gods are approachable, and therefore references to theoi can function as requests for help. In the second notion, anonymity is taken to mean that these theoi are unavailable for communication. References to theoi in this sense are, Versnel has categorized, never requests for aid or support, but rather concern the assignment of causality. So, for instance, in the Demosthenes quote we looked at, theos is the origin of whatever man has to face. When the gods are a comprehensive anonymous notion, a reference to this category may provide a cause for disaster, but is not helpful as to the desire for solution, help, or recovery. Being an unapproachable supernatural principle, the gods cannot be mollified and there is no point in prayer or sacrifice. This categorization and classification is useful to think with, as it allows us to dig deeper into the connotations and nuances which the generic terms theoi and theos can carry with them. In a polytheistic system in which naming practices were crucial and addressing deities by their correct names and epithets was important, unnamed deities stand out. What implications or suggestions might the inscription of the term theoi at the head of a stele carry with it? Can this heading be classified into one of the two categories of theoi discussed? One of these two categories. Generally, we can often deduce from the context which of the two meanings or connotations a particular reference to gods might carry. In the case of the theoi and theos heading found on inscribed documents, immediate context is, of course, lacking. But nonetheless, I think we can place the heading in the second category discussed here. It is evident that theos in the singular does not signify a particular individual god, and the fact that the singular and plural versions of the heading are interchangeable shows that they both refer to a general, unified, and collective sense of divinity. This understanding of the theoi heading as a reference to the anonymous collectivity of gods then has consequences for what the heading means. It confirms that theoi or theos should not be considered as an appeal to the divine. Instead, the inclusion of anonymous divinity at the top of inscriptions should better be understood as an attribution of course, as a recognition of the presence and, importantly, of the power of the divine in the processes which resulted in the inscription of the stele. In this way, it is the simple presence of theoi or theos on the stone which, in the first place, deserves our attention. Even before thinking of theoi, theos as nominative, bringing the gods in as active agents, we must recognize the inscription of this heading bringing the gods in. It indisputably summons the divine, awards them a presence in the space of the stele, the monument, and its inscription. Theoi or theos refers not only to the divine itself, but to the presence of this divine and consequently also to the effects of this divine presence, even if the details of this might not be known. So far in this talk, then I have painted quite a neat picture of how the Greeks referred to and communicated with the gods through referring to them on their inscriptions, with different formula employed to ask the gods for benefaction, to express honor to the gods, and lastly, to recognize the divine power and presence of the gods. However, the last thing I want to do today in this talk is to complicate this picture somewhat. Let's look back at the inscription we started with, the document concerning Phidias' statue of Athena. Here we find Tuche in the nominative, referenced alongside Theoi in Athena. So the inclusion of Athena is of course interesting. First we have this generic anonymous Theoi, but then one particular deity is pulled out of this collective designation. The relevance of the choice is obvious on an inscription which details financial payments made to build a statue for Athena. But it's very rare to find individual deities named in a heading in this similar format of Theos or Theoi. And it's interesting here that it occurs on such an early example, where the heading was then also later retracted on the finished version of the document. So perhaps this shows some early experimentation with different ways in which to express the relevance of the divine to the recording of decision-making and human actions. Secondly, we have here also Tuche in the nominative. From the late 5th century onwards, we occasionally find this Tuche in the nominative alongside Theos or Theoi. Mostly, this form of the heading occurs simply as Theoi Tuche or Theos Tuche. So how should we understand this? Does this manifestation of Tuche in the nominative suggest a different relationship to the Theos or Theoi it accompanies compared to the more common occurrences we've already looked at of Tuche in the accusative and dative? Delphi shows us something interesting too. Here we find a collection of proxeni decrees from roughly the same time period, which show that the nominative, dative, and accusative forms of Tuche can be employed together with Theoi and Theos interchangeably, it seems. So to understand this, we need to recognize that the notion of Tuche, fortune or fate, has a complex history in ancient Greece, which Professor Pirenne has also touched upon in her lectures here a few years ago on the categorization of divine beings and the notions of daimon and Tuche. Tuche is a multi-layered notion, an unknowable power which makes its appearance in our sources in different models or languages of luck and fate. This is especially so in classical Greece before the crystallization in the Hellenistic period of one of these models in the personification of Tuche as a cult goddess. But even in the Hellenistic period, Tuche is worshipped in different forms and guises, from a deity operational in the individual sphere as protector goddess, to a powerful political presence as city guardian linked to rulers. Esther Eidenau has recently illustrated how such various different models of fate could exist concurrently in the ancient world. Taking as example two speeches from Demosthenes and Aeschines from the same trial on the crown, she has shown how the two orators can present different conceptions of Tuche at the same time. Sometimes Tuche is temporary prosperity, sometimes Tuche is unavoidable and unchanging force, sometimes Tuche is portrayed as a fixed notion of personalized luck tied to individuals, and sometimes it is a placatable broader force linked to a city's fortune. In all these different models, Tuche is an operational force of life. So in inscriptions, we therefore also see a variety of ways in which Tuche could be invoked as heading, fitting in with these variety of models of fate and fortune which existed. It is this cognitive messiness, as Eidenau puts it, which helps us focalize on the essence of the meaning presented in the divine headings which reference Tuche. Whether Theoi Tuche Agathe, Theos Tuchen Agathan, or Theoi Agathe Tuche. These forms all carried out similar functions. They include a reference to Theos Theoi, to a generic notion of the divine, unknown and anonymous, whose presence is highlighted. It is a statement of fact, God or gods. Tuhir's appearance alongside this, similarly, is not a reference to a particular deity, but a reference to the notion of fortune, whether or not that notion is portrayed as an object, asking the gods for good fortune, or whether Tuhir is presented as a more separate power, on equal footing perhaps with the divine in the nominative form, as is the case also with the Athena statue. Whether or not this latter portrayal is a personification per se, or an expression of a different kind of form that this force Tuhir can take, does not really matter. The crucial thing is that Tuhir is an operational force in life, though what exact form it takes is not necessarily fixed. So, to conclude, we've seen that there are different ways in which the ancient Greeks referred to and included the gods in their laws and decrees, their regulations which they recorded and displayed on stone. The invocation Theoi or Theos should be distinguished from blessing formulas such as Agathe Tuche or descriptors of divine possession. While those are all forms of expressive honouring of the gods or demands to the gods, Theoi or Theos should be understood instead as a statement of divine presence, as a recognition of the presence and consequent power of the divine. The gods are an active force. This evidently was an idea or a notion which was apparent and clear enough that it did not need invariable and constant expression. It did not need to be included on the stone. And likewise, at times, for whatever reason, this recognition of general, unspecified divine power was sometimes deemed to require more specificity, and then we might find a reference to a particular deity or to a different type of formula. Of course, there is an element of formulaicness to this expression and its repetitiveness, so much so that it can be used to parody also the genre of public inscription, as we saw with the graffito with which we opened today. It is a formula which at the same time can be both formulaic and generic, but nonetheless, I think, carry meaningful connotations with it. This connotation is not always perhaps activated, but the potentiality is there, the potentiality of reading the heading with its sense of bringing the gods in. I would also argue that the genericness of the Theoi invocation, often seen as marking it as unimportant, should be regarded as a conscious choice which suits best the purpose of this invocation, and that genericness therefore does not have to be seen per se as a lessening of intensity or meaning. Rather, it is a device which lets know that a reference has relevance to the collectivity of the divine, that is, to the divine tout court, which is present and powerful. This matters, as this presence, this inclusion of the divine on these public documents, reinforces the idea that in actual practice, religion and law in ancient Greece were not considered two normative systems which existed side by side, but that the authority of the gods was recognized in this lawmaking of the Greeks. This idea is visible also in other mechanisms, for example, in the way divine agency is discussed in speeches of the Attic orators, or the way in which religious deviance can be punished by both human and divine sanctions. But it is present too in the epigraphic documents, which are the very physical embodiment of the rule of law and of human decision making. Paying attention to such invocation can perhaps therefore help us better understand the complex ways in which the Greeks conceptualized the relationship between their gods and the regulations and laws which they inscribed on stone. Thank you.